Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 220. With me today, James Jones.
That is a very round number.
Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Jonathan Lindemann.
Your favorite podcaster.
No.
And I'm your host, Jonathan Metz.
Dr. Jonathan Metz.
Pa-da-da!
Bam!
So, that's why I wasn't here last week. I was prepping for my dissertation defense, and it went great. And I'm going to graduate. I feel the same, but it also is just weird knowing that I've been in college for 10.5 years, and that's finally coming to a close.
I've got a theory. Yeah. Next year, when you're not in college, maybe the Bills can finally make the playoffs, because there's a mysterious overlap between you being in college. This all could have ended so much sooner if you just got a damn job, you hippie.
Are you inferring that...
Stinking liberal.
Greg, are you inferring that I, in the process of moving into a larger apartment, I might lose my collection of Buffalo Bills voodoo dolls?
I don't know. I can't explain it. I'm just looking at the facts.
No, I got a lot of congratulations and well wishes, and I thank everybody for that. It was a stressful time in my life that's now sort of wrapping up, and things are improving. I've got time to play more video games and spend more time thinking about the podcast and looking for a job. So then
Johnny finds out what stress is really all about.
Yes, indeed. It's an exciting time, though. It really is. So anyway, I did want to give a programming note that we've decided to delay our discussion of The World Ends With You for Retroactive because we just haven't had enough time to play it. And, it's an RPG, so it's not just us who are struggling to play deep enough into it to say something intelligent, but the listeners as well, I think. So the forum thread will be open. Keep posting your thoughts. And, of course, now we've got the whole holiday coming up with Thanksgiving. So if you're in the U.S. especially, hopefully you'll have some DS downtime and you might get a chance to play more of that, because we would like to have a very solid participation for this one. And I have to say, if you're kind of on the fence about whether you want to play it, I have my pros and cons. I have thoughts both ways, but I do think it's a very interesting game, and especially if you've played other Japanese RPGs and you kind of get bored with the whole menu-based, turn-based battle system, that is the biggest departure with The World Ends With You, is that it has a very different, very fast-paced, touch-controlled battle system. Very action-y. I mean, it's a little bit like a Tales game. Do you think that's fair, James?
Except it controls...
The controls are odd, but I mean, the pace of it is definitely...
Yeah, it's like a Tales game. Maybe it's a little bit slower because it's not quite a brawler, but yeah. Mm. It's definitely closer than most stuff.
So, I mean, I think it's worth checking out, especially if you're kind of interested in an unconventional RPG. So, there's your update. We've got a lot of fun stuff coming up on this episode. We've got Sonic Colors. John has a Choaniki game that we've never talked about.
Yep.
And then we have your listener mail coming up. But I'll kick off the new business since I wasn't here last week. I got 2 weeks worth of games, and I'll try not to spend terribly long on these because apparently I talk the most during new business.
All right, gentlemen, you can come back in about 35 minutes.
I don't know what you're talking about, John.
This is objective fact.
Yeah.
I like to talk about games.
I'll see everybody in about an hour.
Yep.
Peace out.
No, actually, I really kind of want to get all of your thoughts and responses on this, because I've been playing GoldenEye. The new one. The new GoldenEye.
I was about to say, I played that a long time ago.
Yeah. Of course, we talked about the N64 one a couple weeks ago, and about that time I had ordered my copy of the Wii version, and I got that in, and I haven't played super deep into any one part of it, but I've played at least a couple of hours of all three of the different pieces. So that's the single-player campaign, the local split-screen multiplayer, and then the online multiplayer. And the interesting thing is they all feel kind of like three different games. I mean, I think if nothing else, you get a lot for your money with the new GoldenEye. There's just a lot of stuff. There's tons of content and features and game types and just different variations on stuff. And I guess I'll start with the campaign. You know, I really like the campaign from the N64 game. I mean, it was the first time I'd really played an interesting first-person shooter campaign mode. I mean, it was just leaps and bounds beyond Doom and Quake and that kind of stuff, which was kind of my prior experience. And the Wii version is really good at sort of playing on your memories of what the N64 game was like without actually being a really strict recreation of it. So in other words, like, if I went back and played the N64 campaign now, I'd probably be kind of disappointed with how simple it is and how, you know, how crude the environments are and how, I don't know, binary some of the mission objectives are. And I think the Wii game does a nice job of reminding you of all those things that you liked about the original game, but it's so much more advanced. In fact, it's the most sophisticated shooter I've played on the Wii, by far, really. I mean, I'm not including Metroid Prime 3 because it's really a very different kind of game. I mean, it's so exploration-based, and the shooting is not a huge emphasis there. But with GoldenEye, I mean, compared to, like, The Conduit single-player, holy shit, this is 10 years more advanced than The Conduit single-player.
That's not fair. It's got to be at least 20 years more advanced than that game.
This is a modern first-person shooter, and it feels like it. I mean, it's very slick. It's not overproduced, I don't think. And the nice thing is, I mean, I've heard a lot of people compare it to Call of Duty, and I think in some ways that applies, but in a lot of other ways, it has all these aspects of what made GoldenEye so much fun, with the mission objectives, with the way the AI works, with the way the levels are designed, with the kind of weapons that you have, with the kind of sneaking around that you do as Bond, that you don't get in Halo and Call of Duty and stuff like that. I mean, it's really specific to GoldenEye, or at least to James Bond, to playing that kind of secret agent shooter. And there's tons of shooting, too. But that mix makes it feel different from any of the other modern first-person shooters that I've played recently. So I think it very nicely captures that.
When people compare it to Call of Duty, the hair stands up on the back of my neck because my first thought is, oh, hell, it's just a straight line with real-time cutscenes. Is that the case here, or is it?
No.
Oh, good. Then it's nothing like Call of Duty.
Yeah, I mean, I think really that's not a very appropriate comparison. I mean, there might be certain things. I mean, certainly it benefits from things that we've learned, you know, through Call of Duty about auto-aiming and
sure
movement speed and, you know, just the pacing of encounters and things like that. But it doesn't really feel like Call of Duty. I've played plenty of Call of Duty, and it feels quite different, actually.
Okay.
So there aren't monster closets with infinite spawns of enemies and stuff like that. It's not like a super impenetrable story and stuff like that. It's, you know, it feels a lot like GoldenEye. It's just way more up-to-date, way more modern, and just presented extremely well. Really extremely
well. I mean,
I haven't
played many of the modern first-person shooters apart from Killzone 2, but, I mean, when I think about, you know, how different they are just based on what I've heard and read and seen and whatnot, it's, you know, kind of set pieces come to mind, you know, that are, you know, as James kind of alluded to, you know, the more directed experiences, at least within a part of a level. I mean, is there some of that in GoldenEye?
There's some of it, probably a little more than in the N64 game, but there are also elements of minor exploration. I mean, you have a radar that kind of tells you the general direction you need to be going, but not necessarily the path.
People radar, yes.
And there are dead ends. I mean, you're walking through this underground base in the dam and these office buildings and things like that, and there are empty rooms. There might be a guy in there with a gun. There might be maybe some kind of bonus mission objective that you don't have to worry about until you're playing on the hardest difficulty. But for the most part, it's just an empty room, you know? And so there's some wandering around a little bit, which reminds me a lot of the original GoldenEye when there are plenty of empty rooms.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I mean, I think that's one of the problems with, like, Call of Duty is that basically if you don't need to go there, it doesn't exist.
That's right. There's a door and it won't open.
Yeah, it's like it's all bang, 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 very quick action. There's no exploration.
Yeah, the amazing thing about when I first played Modern Warfare was I was amazed at how many locked doors the U.S. military can't open.
Very true.
There are locked doors in GoldenEye. But it seems to be quite frequent from what I've played so far that you sort of come up to an intersection and there are two or three different ways that you could possibly go. And you may not know which one you need to do. And it's also possible if you're playing on a higher difficulty, it's possible to miss an objective. So it kind of encourages you, if you want to get all the objectives and you have to at certain difficulties, it behooves you to actually explore and try to find every nook and cranny so you can find, you know, the schematic on the wall so you can take a picture of it with your smartphone, which is similar to some stuff that you did in the original GoldenEye, except now you use your phone instead of a camera, you know, stuff like that. There's a line of dialogue where they reference Blackwater, the mercenary group. So it's... it's minor stuff. The story arc seems to be pretty faithful to the movie GoldenEye, and therefore to the game as well, to the N64 game. But it's more fleshed out. I mean, now they can do more with voice acting and cinematic scenes and stuff like that. So it feels more like the movie now. And of course, legally, this is based on the movie and not the Rare N64 game. But, you know, this is made by Eurocom. You know, they made The World Is Not Enough on GameCube, I think.
Was N64. That?
Okay. So they made, Nightfire on GameCube. And it was a multi-platform game. But, I mean, they've made Bond games before, so I think they're a really good choice for this. And as you've seen with, like, Dead Space Extraction, they know how to run the Wii hardware as well. I mean, they know how to get a lot out of it. And they have a nice sort of cinematic style to the games that they make. And you can really see that in Dead Space Extraction. What I was concerned about is just that, you know, Dead Space Extraction didn't do much for me from a gameplay standpoint. I mean, it is a rail shooter. It's just not that interesting. You can add as much stuff on top of it, presentation-wise, as you want, and I can say, wow, that was a really cool cutscene, but now I'm moving this damn cursor around and I can't control where I look. You know, it's just intrinsically frustrating to me, that very limited gameplay. So I was just kind of concerned about, like, how well can they do a shooter on the Wii? I mean, it's just a very different kind of engine, because now you have full range of motion, and you can look and go anywhere you want to, and there's so much more variety in guns and AI, because, I mean, you know, you're not on a directed path, so you don't just have dudes jumping out at you. They now have to be somewhere in the environment, and you may or may not walk right up to them. You know, so there's just a lot. This is so much more of a complex game than Extraction, and I'm extremely impressed with what they've done here. And seeing how good it is actually kind of makes me sad that Extraction was a rail shooter, because I think that, I mean, they could have made a real Dead Space game for Wii, and for whatever reason, probably budgetary, probably publisher decision, but they didn't, or they couldn't. And that's too bad, because, you know, I've said before, I just felt like Extraction could have been a lot more. And when you play GoldenEye, you realize that I'm right, because it really could have been an actual Dead Space game. I mean, these is totally within their power to do that. And GoldenEye is an extremely impressive game. Not only technically, I mean, it just looks fantastic on the Wii, and it runs really well, but it's so sophisticated. It's really modern. It's, I mean, this is a legit shooter. It's not a good shooter for the Wii. It's a good shooter. I like this. I'm having more fun with this so far than I did with Modern Warfare 2. I mean, I never even, I still to this day have not even touched the online multiplayer in Modern Warfare 2. I played it in the first one. That's not really why I bought the second one. You know, I wanted to play the single and co-op. Just, I haven't gotten around to it. Maybe I will one day. But with GoldenEye, it was one of the first things I wanted to do. Boot up the online multiplayer, and wow, it's really, really fun. Really fun. I played it for several hours already.
Does it feel fair? Does it feel like that
yeah.
you have a chance?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that's no good.
There were a few matches where I was kind of didn't do very well at all. You know, I didn't know the maps. I didn't know, understand the weapon loadouts and all that crap. But I didn't feel intimidated. I mean, even just jumping into it without any kind of setup, I still knew how to play it. I mean, it's not that much different from, like, local multiplayer. It's just the maps feel a lot bigger. There's more stuff going on. You're gaining experience. The modes are a fair bit more complex online. It's great, man. It's really, really good. And again, I hate to bash on the Conduit, but I played a fair bit of the Conduit online, and this is night and day.
Yes, yes, we did. Yep. You lose. What?
There's just a not only a level of competency, but a level of fun and engagement,
and a level of games not ending suddenly.
Yeah, let me ask. Like when you hop,
much less glitchy too. Yes.
Yeah. So when you hop into an online game, you don't sit there. And you're able to move the camera, but you can't move at all. And this goes on for about 5 minutes until the game ends.
That's right.
I have to tell you.
You lose. Please wait for the next 7 minutes.
Yep.
GoldenEye has worked perfectly online for me so far. I'm not saying I'll never see a problem, but it's getting into a match is very fast, and it runs well. It still looks good. It doesn't look like an N64 game like the Conduit did when you went online with it.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you would expect. I mean, it's really what you demand.
Like, how many players can you have maximum in a match?
Eight.
Eight or 12, maybe, but I'm not exactly sure. I mean, this isn't MAG. But I think the size of the levels is pretty good if you have a full set, you know? And so the local, I haven't played, that's the one I've played the least of is local. But I did get to play it for maybe an hour the other night with a friend, so we just played two player. And the levels are definitely a lot smaller in local, in split screen. I mean, it's a separate mode, completely separate from the online. And the levels are different. The levels are tuned to be much more like the N64 game. Mm-hmm. And the whole feel of it feels more like that. I mean, it's the kind of stuff where most of your kills are going to be up close. We're just coming around a corner and you see your friend and you shoot him in the face. I mean, my friend had a blast trying to kill me with Oddjob's hat. He thought awesome. That was the funniest thing ever. But we had a great time. It's simple. It's very old school, but I mean, I think that's probably what you want with that mode, right? And then, you know, if you decide, well, I kind of want something, I want more than this. I want something a little more advanced, a little more skill based, probably not quite as luck based as the split screen, then you can go online and it's great. I wish there was like split screen online, you know, like you get in Mario Kart where you and a friend can both go online together. I don't think it supports that. That would be great.
No, I don't think it does it? Which is, I guess some of that may go into the fact, as you said, they are like almost discrete games. So it's not surprising they don't kind of intersect that way.
Yeah, that's always a nice feature. But so far, really everything about GoldenEye, I'm pretty damn impressed by. And I'm very happy with my purchase so far. I really am. I'm excited to play a lot more of it. And I just think if you've played a couple other first-person shooters on Wii and you've been kind of like, well, you know, it's like this downgraded port, but it works. It's okay. I think this is going to blow your mind, because this is, to me, this is as good as anything you can get on any system. And it's just got all the features, it does everything you want it to do, and it doesn't just pay lip service to all those features like the conduit, it actually does them properly, and they work.
So before we go on, I'm going to ask, do you want to get any more digs in at the conduit before we asked Eric Nofsinger to be on the show for the live show?
No, look, I've talked to those guys, we've interviewed them, and I think no one is more critical of their first game than they are. If you read any interview with them about Conduit 2, they pretty much take a shit on the first Conduit every time they talk about Conduit 2.
We already did. Except for John's 8.0. Nice, John.
I think they know what they did wrong, and I'm really curious about the Conduit 2.
I stand by my score.
Do you really?
Heroic.
I mean, I'm not saying Conduit 2 will be bad. I think the first one was really not a very good game, and I think they have a great chance to do something very, very, very different and much better with Conduit 2, and I'm quite curious to see how it turns out. But, dude, the first Conduit's not a good game. If anyone had fun with it, I'm so glad. But
John did.
I enjoyed it. I mean, I thought it was an 8 or whatever I gave it.
You gave it an 8, yes.
There's one feature I could think of that I think Conduit 2 will have over GoldenEye, which I think will resonate with fans of Perfect Dark, is that it has bots in the split screen.
Yes. Oh, that would be cool. I was kind of wanting that, since we only had the two of us. I was looking for that in the options, and I didn't find anything. And yeah, that would be great.
Because, I mean, that was part of why, for me, Perfect Dark as a multiplayer game took it up the whole other level, is the screwy stuff you could do with bots. And definitely, two-player becomes a lot more fun over a longer period when you can put bots in the mix. You know, if it's just one-on-one, that's got a bit of a shelf life there that runs out before too long, probably.
You're absolutely right.
And since we're giving them the benefit of the doubt, let's give them just a straight-up doubt. Tournament of Legends. That's all it needs to be said.
I have no comment on Tournament of Legends, but I will say the other thing Conduit 2 might be able to improve on is it does support that headset and
the Phantom headset. Yes.
Well, the headset's out. It's out.
I actually have one sitting right in front of me, as a matter of fact.
Why? Wow.
I requested one.
So anyway, the thing is, having played a good bit of GoldenEye online now, you know, if you're just going in there to shoot everybody else up, every man for himself, whatever, voice chat is irrelevant. It's more annoying than anything in that setting.
Yeah.
But when you get into, like, there's a mode called the Leader or Leaders, and it's a really interesting idea. I've never seen it in another game, but basically every round, you're in teams, and one player from each team is given the option to transform into the leader, which basically changes your character model into one of the story characters from the campaign. So it could be James Bond, it could be General Orimov or whatever. And you get, like, increased damage, increased health, and you get this, like, radius effect where any of your teammates who are near you will heal and they'll be stronger too. And also you will show up on the other team's radar. So the goal of the mode is basically to kill the other team's leader. And so it's fun to be the leader because you're more powerful and a lot of your teammates will flock around you naturally because of the healing effect, but it also means the other team is after you, so you're now the target. It's really interesting mode, but it would be better with voice chat. I mean, it's just one of those things where you would want to be able to coordinate it a little bit. And it's interesting because the game does play voice samples from the characters based on what's happening. So sometimes if you're near another guy on your team, and he starts to reload, he will say, "Cover me, I'm reloading." But of course, that's just being automatically generated by the game. So there's no actual communication, and that's a problem with certain team modes. So it depends on the mode you're playing. I certainly had a great time with it regardless, but it's just one of those things where voice chat would improve it. It would. And I wish it was an option. I don't know why it's not, but, you know, that's somewhere where the Conduit 2 might be able to one-up GoldenEye a little bit. All right, I have talked plenty already, so I will move very quickly through these other two games. First off, Split Second. I played this on Xbox. I rented it. It's a racing game. It came out earlier this year, and I don't know exactly why I rented it, but it's fun.
Because it's pretty.
It is pretty. Have you played it, James?
Yeah, it's been at like 3 press events we've gone to.
Yeah, okay. I played demos before too, but I mean, this is the real game. I played a few hours of it, and I had a good time. It's not... I don't know. It's nothing amazing or super innovative or anything. It reminds me kind of Burnout 3 or Burnout 4, you know, before they went all open world with it. Cause it's just like it's not point to point. It's like 2-lap or 3-lap races.
It's to kind of bring it back to what we described Call of Duty earlier. It's like Call of Duty of racing. There's a bunch of big events at certain points on the racetrack.
Yeah. There's all these scripted events, but you trigger them.
Right.
I mean, the players trigger them. So basically you do a lot of the stuff that you would do in Burnout, like you're drifting around corners or you're jumping or you're drafting in the slipstream behind another car, and that fills up your meter, but there's no boost, there's no nitro. So once your meter fills up to a certain point, it lets you activate these scripted events. They're basically traps laid around the track. And you have to time it. It's actually really tricky timing because they're mostly like explosions and sometimes there's a helicopter and when you push the button, it'll drop this barrel of fire, whatever.
Yes, it's just a fire barrel.
And you can always see it up ahead. So you're always triggering things that are up in front of you. And if you don't time it right, you can actually get caught in your own trap, which feels bad. It makes you feel like an idiot. And it definitely makes it hard to win. So, there's some interesting mechanics there, but they never fully clicked with me. I never really felt like they were as fun as they probably should be. Because of the timing is so tricky, I'd say I had about a 50% success rate with those traps, and that's not really enough to make it feel like they're worth doing, especially when you consider the danger that you might actually hurt yourself when you use them. There's something to be said for the strategy of just playing it like a vanilla racer, because then you don't have to deal with all that stuff. And, you know, the tracks are super contrived. I mean, obviously, they're basically, the premise is you're on this TV show and they're basically sets that have been triggered with all these special effects, you know, and it's like a game show. But it's just not, the aesthetic of it's not that interesting, and the racing is good, but it's not as good as Burnout. And the other thing is you can't take down the other racers. I mean, you can't, like, shove them into the wall and make them crash or anything. And so it just feels all very, like, passive-aggressive. You know, it's like, I can't knock you off the road with my car, and I can't shoot you with a missile or a banana peel or something like that, but I can trigger this thing 100 yards up the road that may or may not make you get blasted off the track. It's just, I don't know, it's never super satisfying.
So it's sort of like all you have is a blue shell all the time.
Only sometimes that blue shell comes around and hits you in the face.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a really good analog for it in Mario Kart. I mean, it's easy to compare it to Mario Kart because it's a combat racer. But yeah. In Mario Kart, the weapons come from you. I mean, you sort of choose how to aim them and it's up to your skill and, you know, there's a lot of player choice there. When the weapons are built into the track, it feels all kind of disconnected from what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's not as much fun. But anyway, it's an interesting game. And then Costume Quest is a downloadable RPG, basically. It's on Xbox and PlayStation. It really should be on Wii, because the graphics are not anything amazing to look at. There's no voice acting. So, I mean, it seems like the kind of thing that probably could be done on Wii if they just took the effort. It's made by Double Fine. It's a small company, so I can kind of understand, but it's really a shame, because Costume Quest is really cute. I mean, it totally fits the stereotypical Wii demographic anyway, but it's also really, really strongly imitates Super Mario RPG. So, I mean, I certainly think most Nintendo fans would find a lot to like with this game, Costume Quest. I certainly had a great time with it. It's really cute, but also funny. It has a lot of jokes that... It's not really a game made for kids. I think it would be fine if kids played it, but most of the writing is more stuff that only an adult would get. And in a lot of cases, the humor is that kids would be saying this stuff. You know, it's like the kids don't talk like kids necessarily.
That's kind of a Double Fine trademark.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they make funny games, and this is definitely very amusing. And I love the premise of a game set around Halloween, which is very unusual, really. And even a game that actually uses autumn as a theme for the setting. The whole game takes place in basically the time of year when Halloween occurs. And you just never really see that. And I would love to see them make a sequel that's set in the winter or the spring or the summer, you know, because they seem to have a good grasp of this whole seasonal thing. And it looks really good. Not a fan of the music. I actually listen to podcasts most of the time I was playing it, but...
Man, F this music.
Otherwise, the game's really charming. It's very simple. I mean, it imitates Mario RPG and Mario and Luigi down to the point where you have stamps that are like the badges that enhance different stats.
Aren't you the mushroom shape, just out of curiosity?
It's hard to tell, actually, with the way the graphics are. But, I mean, you have the timing-based actions during battle where, you know, you push B at a certain time and you'll do extra damage or you'll counterattack. It's very simple, but it's satisfying, it's fun, and the whole theme of the game is just really endearing, you know, and it makes you want to play through the end, and the whole thing's like 5 or 6 hours, so it's kind of an RPG for people who don't have time for RPGs, and I appreciated that. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. For $15, I was very happy with it. I'd love to play more of it, and again, it should be on the Wii. It's kind of a shame, but if you have a way to play it, I would recommend that you check it out. All right, Greg, finally it's your turn. I will shut the fuck up for a while.
Can I get that in writing?
I'm done.
Fair enough. Well, first of all, I should say I did pick up my copy of GoldenEye today. I've not played it yet, so I'll be cracking on with that in the next few weeks. That should be fun. I haven't really had what I would call a first-person shooter on Wii yet. Mm-hmm. Red Steel 2 is like a brawler. Basically,
yeah,
and
it is.
And we've already covered the prime example.
It's an FPB.
It is. But what I've been playing the last week, also seen most of it at this point, is Sonic Colors for the Wii, which, you know, obviously I played the DS demo, which I enjoyed, as we covered. But with the Wii game, it's been getting mixed reviews still.
I've seen really good reviews for it.
But it's skewing more positive.
It's on the other side of mixed from your average Sonic game, let's put it that way. It's not mixed as in like,
so has it broken the Sonic cycle? That's what we want to know.
I don't know, because that's the thing. I'm not coming to this with any of that baggage.
Everybody comes to it with baggage, Greg. You just don't know it.
You know, they would probably, Sega could probably break the Sonic cycle themselves if they would just not make 5 Sonic games every year.
I think my sort of, when we were talking about, you know, whether Sonic Colors for the DS would get crowded out or whatever, one thing that tickled me was looking at, I think, more than one major gaming website right around the time that Sonic Colors was coming out for Wii and DS in America. And, of course, what you see is the image of Sonic on the front page for the Free Riders Connect game.
Oh, no!
Which has been getting terrible reviews.
One game called it a war crime. Or one site called it that.
It's getting dumped on, and, you know, obviously completely separate games, but just for the brand, you know, they talk about pulling these, like, bad games from retail.
Don't worry, this game will get
to sort of detoxify the brand, and then you've got something like that coming out alongside Solid
that,
Colors.
That,
it's
that game
sad.
Is so bad, they're going to need a Superfund project to clean up the damage.
So I looked at the reviews. I read enough good things that this is the kind of game that I could enjoy. A sort of quick twitch, kind of action feel to it, more platforming, which I've got a pretty insatiable appetite for. And really why I kind of went with the Wii version of the DS version is just that it would be, you know, something a bit more unique compared to, you know, the Colors for DS is so similar to Rush on DS that, yeah, I felt like I could probably wait, maybe pick that up down the road sometime. So I went with the Wii version, and like I said, seen pretty much all of the game there in most respects. There are secret levels that you unlock that kind of play out in this stripped-down, quote-unquote, Sonic Simulator mode.
Interesting.
It's an interesting structure. I'll sort of get back to that point in a bit, but the main levels, you know, set in this interplanetary, I should say, amusement park. Yeah, so there's a little bit of a kind of nod to some of the Galaxy stuff there, especially because, like, quite randomly, there's some orchestral music in it, and yet the rest of the, you know, the rest of the music is like more what you would expect from Sonic. Is especially unfortunate in the case of the intro theme song, which is ear-splittingly terrible. But the rest of it is actually pretty good music-wise. But yeah, so you've got all these different environments, typical Sonic kind of stuff rendered in 3D. You know, like the casino kind of zone and the green zone, all that kind of stuff. But looks really good. Very impressed with the graphics. There's always a hell of a lot going on. The levels are kind of split up into periods where you're playing 2D side-scrolling Sonic type stuff, and then others where you're mostly running into the screen, the 3D parts, which a lot of the time you're not doing a whole hell of a lot. There it is, interactive to some extent. They kind of switch it up. Sometimes you're steering Sonic around corners with like a power slide kind of thing all of a sudden, which is weird. Other time you don't really have analog control of him, you just like lane switching in these situations, so it's always kind of limited interactivity. But the good news is it usually takes you on this kind of crazy visual journey that at least is arresting in that sense. You got asteroid roller coasters, you sort of switching between tracks, and then like hitting chains of asteroids with the homing attack to get from planet to planet. And it's extremely bright, it's extremely busy and pretty dazzling, really. I'm very impressed with the graphical work. Then with the platforming sections, the key thing here compared to other Sonic games is it's a bit more Mario-like from the point of view that you do have these ability-changing power-ups. I mean, the only case I could think of with Sonic is probably Sonic 3, right? I mean, I haven't played that, but they had those like force fields or whatever. So here you've got a bunch of different color-based power-ups. Some are kind of more substantive than others. You know, you've got like one that where you transform into a laser that you can plot the trajectory and sort of fire off into other parts of the level. You've got a drill where you can go really, I mean, deep into some of these levels. It's really surprising how much real estate there is that you might not know about until you come back to somewhere with a new power up. And that's something that to me is not something I would have associated with Sonic before this. You know, you kind of unlock one of these color based power ups in one level, go back to a previous one, and you'll see huge sections of the level that you haven't seen before. And the big thing for that is that you don't have secret exits or anything like that in that you would have had in Mario World, but you do have the very star coin like red coins, which there's 5 on each level, and the more you collect, the more you unlock these secret levels in this Sonic Simulator thing. And the thing about those levels is the graphics are really stripped down, so it kind of just makes me think, well, we want to put more levels in the game. We can put more levels in the game, but it'd be a bit much to actually, you know, do the visual design to the standard that, you know, you see, as I've described, in all the regular levels. So why don't we just say, oh, it's like this vaguely 8-bit kind of aesthetic, and it's just strip it down. And from the ones I've played so far anyway, seems like it's very light on those 3D sections accordingly. Because as I say, if you take the visual aspect out of those, there's not a whole lot going on there.
Yeah.
So those levels, you know, what I've played of them are pretty good. But as I say, it does seem like they were kind of realistic about, well, you know, there's only so many of the kind of full production value levels we can make. But let's not limit the game's content to that. So I think this kind of making the doing the best with what they have.
So in terms of the Mario feel or the Mario elements that you described, that sounds really promising to me, but I guess my concern would be whether that stuff is compatible with the speed and the controls of Sonic.
Yeah, well, I mean, control-wise, I think there are some issues. I mean, one of the areas where it's not entirely kind of successful. Because I think when if you're just trying to get from beginning to the end of the level, the controls will generally not be a problem. I mean, you have a double jump, which can help you finesse certain things when you're going really fast, that you can kind of make an adjustment there in midair. And if you just try to get from start to finish, the platforming is not typically that challenging, apart from maybe a few things towards the end. But when you get to some of these things where you're trying to find, you know, these sort of tricky challenges, a bit like, you know, something like New Super Mario Bros. Wii, where you're trying to find these additional coins or you're using the power-ups in conjunction with that, then the controls are not quite, they feel like they're not quite fit for purpose. You know, you're trying to go from one little platform to another little platform to another little platform. You feel like, yeah, this doesn't feel quite tight as you would hope. So it's not by no means, you know, really inadequate, but I think there's a little bit of a mismatch there. But on the other hand, those aren't like essential. They're not core parts of the experience. They're a little bit additional, getting all those red coins. So it's not a huge problem, but I think it is a deficiency. And the powers themselves are kind of variable in how fun they are to use. I mean, some of my favourites would probably be, there's a pink one where you turn into a spiky ball, which is kind of like a supercharged version of the Sonic Spin Dash, which isn't kind of otherwise in the game. And with that, you can sort of stick to walls and ceilings however you like and just zoom around them really fast and find, you know, again, completely different parts of the level that you wouldn't have known were there before. Things like that are really fun. Whereas other ones, there's like a... I guess it's vaguely like the blimp fruit with Yoshi in Galaxy 2, this floating power-up. The stuff with that is, you know, a bit slow and just tedious by comparison. So it's a little bit erratic in how effective those are. But certainly the best thing about them is that they allow the pace of the game to kind of take breaks, to slow down, but not be completely uninteresting. Most of the time, these things provide some sort of gameplay wrinkle. There's variety there, and that is fun. So I think that's probably the biggest sort of achievement that they've brought to Sonic for me. As my memories of, especially of the Genesis game, was that, you know, obviously you had certain amount of zipping around, which was not so emphasized in the original game. But then when it would slow down, it would be kind of painful. You know, it'd be all these like really close jumps over spikes and, or like the underwater level or levels were like really painful. I mean, those are actually fun in this. There's a few of them. And what happens mostly is that you use the drill power up underwater. So it's like you're piloting a super fast submarine under it, which is just the complete opposite of what those levels were like in the original Genesis game. So I think they definitely deal with pacing better. And the level design is solid, not particularly inspired, and a little bit inconsistent. You know, certain levels are really quite long, and then others are quite short and sort of one note by comparison in terms of the kinds of gameplay ideas they use. So a little spotty there, but generally I enjoyed it. As to how long-term sort of Sonic fans will take it, I have no idea, really. I can only recommend it on its own merits. It's a well-put-together game that, you know, I think certainly you don't have to be a Sonic fan to enjoy it, which, you know, is perhaps quite a statement.
But if you've already got Stockholm Syndrome, might have give you a better chance.
Possibly.
Well, it sounds great. Consider it game-flied. So, James, what the hell is Reseteer?
Yes. So, I actually played this a while ago, but for whatever reason, it just kept getting pushed back when we had new business. But Reseteer is an indie game developed in Japan that was localized by an individual and released on Steam.
Oh, okay. I thought this was an Atlas thing.
No. This is weird by Atlas standards.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah, so basically...
they make the game where the children shoot themselves in the head to go to their high school fantasy land, right?
Yeah, it's true. We're not going to talk about Persona. We're going to leave that out of here. But the basic premise of Reseteer is that you are this young girl whose father has essentially vanished and left her with the mortgage on their house, essentially. She has to come up with the money to pay the mortgage.
So it's like Winter's Bone.
Sure.
Okay, never mind.
It's eventually determined that she'll make this money by running a store out of the first floor of her home. And basically, it's as the game builds itself with its motto is capitalism ho. So essentially, your premise is you buy things on the cheap and then sell them for profit at your store. And basically, you have to haggle with all your customers to how much you'll buy their crap for and how much you're willing to take to sell stuff to them. Now, that would be an interesting game of itself because the game's weird. It's got this really strange, quirky sense of humor. There are some characters that are shady at best, and the game has fun with them. Some characters have a slight bit too much interest in the main character, even though she's rather young, and the game makes fun of them thoroughly for it. But the game has a secondary mode, which basically you go into these dungeons and you hire an adventurer to collect goods for you by killing enemies. So what you get whatever they drop and whatever treasures you find, and then if you make it out of the dungeon, you can then sell that stuff in your store for a much larger profit because you didn't actually have to buy it.
Okay, I got to stop you real quick because I want to ask if you have ever played Dragon Quest IV.
No.
There is a chapter, you know, that's the one with all the chapters where you play as different characters. There's a chapter that is my favorite chapter in that game where you play as Tornico, the merchant, and you run a shop and you buy things and you sell them for a profit and then you go in dungeons and collect items and take them back to your store so you can sell them. It sounds exactly like that.
That sounds very similar, yes.
Well, that chapter in Dragon Quest IV was so popular in Japan that Tornico, the merchant, became like a popular character even outside of the Dragon Quest franchise, and actually one of the very earliest mystery dungeon games from Chunsoft was based around Tornico.
No!
Just wanted to draw the line between what you're talking about and mystery dungeons so that you will hate it.
Well, you see,
I'm kidding.
It does use the three word sin.
Randomly generated dungeons.
Yes. However, the combat isn't turn-based RPG bullshit. It actually controls a lot like the 2D Zelda games. So it's top-down, and you're just killing enemies in these labyrinths. Hmm. Well, it's not your character. The bodyguards you hire, the adventurers, they do level up with use. They get stronger. They gain some skills. And they can get new equipment by either you buying equipment or finding equipment and bringing it with you on adventures, and risking it if you don't complete the mission. Because if you don't complete a dungeon, you lose your stuff. Mm-hmm. Or you can sell them stuff in your shop on the cheap, so they'll buy it. And then they'll use the upgraded equipment they bought from you in when you're out collecting stuff.
But you directly control them?
You do,
yes. Adventurers?
Yes.
Okay. So does it feel pretty much like Zelda?
It's a little floaty, but it feels a lot like Zelda. I mean, it's even got your choices of swords or bows, and you can... I think there's shields, but I can't tell yet. And as you progress through these dungeons, you'll get to bosses, and then as you get through them, the dungeon will go, you'll be able to go further into the dungeon, and then you'll get to more dungeons essentially. I think there's a handful of adventurers. I've only got two right now, but it's a good like time burning game. The only problem is that every week you have to make a mortgage payment, and that payment keeps going up, and if you don't make it, you lose.
Is this a week in real time?
No.
Okay.
You get about five things you can do a day, and each one eats up a certain amount of time. So if you go out on an adventure, that eats up the whole day. Mm-hmm. If you run the shop for a session, that eats up a fifth of the day. If you go out shopping, that's like a fifth of the day, stuff like that. So you're going to have to manage your time, and you create lots of save points in case you run out of money or don't have enough money. But to give you kind of an idea of how the game's humor is, if you lose and you run out of money, the main character is seen in an image crying, living in a cardboard box, basically saying, "I'll make this work." And that is the game over screen, a young girl living in a cardboard house. That is the kind of humor this game employs. There is some dark stuff going on in this title.
It sounds really interesting. Do you know about how much it costs on Steam?
I think I paid $12 for it.
Oh, wow.
Like I said, it's kind of a, I'll come back to it every so often and play it when I have some downtime game.
It sounds like a good netbook game.
It probably would be, because, I mean, it's not exactly super intensive.
Yeah.
The game itself in Japan is relatively old. It took them a really long time to do the translation. Although they don't localize any of the voice acting, so you get all the really odd Japanese voice acting. Odd by Japanese standards, because the voices they chose to use.
Huh.
I don't know. I have fun with it. I mean, it's not a great title, but it's, you know, it's got enough charm that it makes it worthwhile to play every so often. What I didn't get when I first was trying to, I was trying to figure out how to pronounce the game, so I'm impressed that Johnny got it right the first time.
Oh, did I? I was guessing.
it's Reciteer, which they point out later in the game sounds awfully close to the phrase racketeer, which probably isn't the image they want to project for their store. Because it's the exact same, the game is named after their store. But, you know, sometimes you make money, sometimes the price of sweets on the island plummets, and all of a sudden your inventory is valueless. It happens.
Okay, so John, I heard you are hopped on the meat train.
Yes, my friend, I hopped on the meat train.
No!
Tell us how great that is.
It's quite good, quite good.
I didn't need to hear that.
Yep, this is Super Meat Boy after hearing Johnny rave about it. And it was a game that I hadn't had my eye on for a while, but of course I was kind of unplugged there for a while. So I plugged the 360
unplugged
back in.
Unplugged from the meat train?
Unplugged from the meat train, yes, James. I know you're going to be using that one for weeks.
Greg, isolate that.
Actually, Johnny pushed me over the edge, and so it was kind of funny. I bought it online on Xbox Live before I even had my 360 plugged in, just so I would
great.
Have something waiting for me when I did plug it back in. So, yeah, I mean, it's really good. It's one of the best games I've played in a long time, just in terms of just being very, very simple. It's very clear what you have to do in every stage that you go into. I really like the light mode and dark mode kind of thing, which is really, really cool. And I think probably what I like most about it are the physics. I think it controls really well. And I don't know if they switch things up. I've played to the first boss, and now I'm going back through the first world, just going through all the dark world stuff. But I don't know if they lay any other kind of control gimmicks on there, but I mean, as it stands, I mean, pretty much you can just, you know, you can jump around normally through each level, or you can kind of run. But the way that you run, you almost have kind of this, you're almost like a magnet, and you kind of stick to a wall ever so slightly. And so you can play around with, you know, you can hop up on a wall and you'll slide down a little bit, because obviously you're a bloody piece of meat. So you kind of stick to the wall a little bit. And it's really interesting, because as you learn the game, you can sit there, and even though when you first start the game, it's kind of overwhelming, because you'll be thrown into these levels with, you know, all kinds of buzzsaws and stuff. But as you go on, and this is one of the things I really like about it, is the fact that the controls are simple, but the way that you use them as a player changes. It gets more complex. But mm-hmm. they don't artificially change up the controls just to make things harder. They make you use them in more and more clever ways, and they present puzzles to you that on the surface looks like you would solve them by doing A, B, and C. But as you completely watch your little meat guy get destroyed over and over again, you realize that you have to do X, Y, and Z and completely approach it in a different way. And sometimes you totally have to throw out your plan. So I don't know, Johnny, I know that you can unlock a whole lot of characters. I don't know what that kind of brings into it.
In terms of the other playable characters, most of them don't seem to be all that useful, but they're all kind of neat to play around with. And I really like some of them you unlock just by collecting a bunch of bandages, which are like the bonus item, like the hidden thing. And then some of them you play through warp zones to unlock them.
Which are also excellent.
Yeah, and for those, the secret characters have their custom levels that are made just for them to take advantage of their powers. And that stuff's really interesting, because that is different physics. I mean, they're just the way the characters control is completely different. Some of them have double jumps and weird changes to the way they stick to walls and the speed that they run at and stuff like that. So it's a chance for you to kind of learn how to use those characters and how they might be useful. And then you can take them into any level in the entire game that you want. except the warp zones. Those you have to use Meat Boy in those. But for, I mean, all the normal levels in the Dark World and all that crap, you can use any of these characters. And so these warp zones kind of train you to maybe identify situations in which some of those other characters might be useful.
I don't know. I just feel like games like this really aren't made very much these days, mm-hmm. where it's something, I mean, it reminds me, a game I often bring up from the 90s is The Incredible Machine, which to me is an example of a game that's just, it's just very simple. Throws you in a stage, you have to solve a puzzle, but the way that they layer things on top of, like puzzles on top of puzzles, and I remember, Johnny, I remember you tweeting.
I don't tweet.
Well, on Facebook then. I remember you actually saying somewhere out there on the internetosphere that you just beat the last level in Super Meat Boy, and you said it was like one of the most satisfying things that you've done in gaming.
Yeah, I was referring to, I unlocked the Kid, which is one of the secret characters, and he's from a game called I Want to Be the Guy. It's an indie game. You can download it for free on the internet, and it's like one of the hardest games ever made. Yeah. I haven't played it. I've watched videos of it, and the videos look fucking nuts. I mean, it really makes Meat Boy look easy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't look fun to me. I mean, it's so brutally hard. It's just one of those things that, like, I think people play it. I don't know. It's just masochistic. Meat Boy's actually fun to me.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the Kid's levels are really brutal. I mean, they're easily some of the hardest levels in all of Super Meat Boy.
Yeah.
And when you first look at it, and they just look impossible. And part of the thing is you're using this character, the Kid, who controls differently than Meat Boy. And you haven't really learned to play as him yet, because you can't. So you can only play him in these stages until you beat them. And I spent probably 3 or 4 hours getting through 3 levels, which, if you combine my successful runs through them, probably last less than 3 minutes total. So, I mean, three hours for 3 minutes of gameplay, it's brutal. It's completely insane, but it's so skill-based. It's not arbitrary at all. It's not like shit jumps out and kills you for no reason.
Yeah.
It felt amazing. I mean, it was one of the most satisfying things I've ever done. And I think I'm probably more proud of completing that than any other video game accomplishment that I can think of. I mean, it was completely insane. It was one of those things where I finished it and I looked back at what I'd done and I don't know that I could do it again.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I can already tell early on in the game that, like, even like, I think the stage I was really having a hard time with was, I think, the one right before the first boss. And it's one in which there's 5 buzzsaws, but they're kind of like, they look like clock pendulums, and they're all just sitting there spinning. And beating it is incredibly easy. You can literally just hop across. But to get the bandage in it is so difficult. And when I finally beat that, I was so psyched. But I also said, I don't know if I could do that again. So it was kind of a one-shot deal. I was like, I'm just going to move on, and I'm not even going to touch that level again because I don't know if I could do what I just did there.
Well, and I think the genius and the subtlety of Super Meat Boy is that nothing in the game seems impossible. It seems almost impossible.
Yeah.
And that is very hard to do in design.
Yeah.
Well, you know, anyone waiting for this game on Wii or WiiWare, I guess that's still up in the air right now, but you are in for a treat.
Yeah.
You really are, my friends, and I hope we've got you all hyped up because it's incredible. It's a really incredible
game. It really is an incredible game.
I think it's out on PC really soon, so if you don't want to wait for the Wii version, you could do that. But you would definitely want a great PC controller. That's the thing. I would not want to play this with keyboard.
That would really suck, actually.
Yeah. Everybody I've recommended this to who's actually tried it has fallen in love with it. All right. And finally, John.
Yeah, so I also hooked up my PS3 again. I mean, hey, I have to plug it in so I can update it, right? So, yeah, after I was done doing this monthly update, I went on PSN, you know, to see if there was any, you know, anything new on there that might be interesting on the store.
Uh-oh. Is it phallic?
Well, I went to the Japan imports.
Oh no.
Yeah, and there was a game in there called Chouaniki.
I've never heard of
it. So I decided to download it
on a whim.
On a whim, you know, I figured, hey, it sounded interesting. You know, had kind of neat box art.
I've heard of this somewhere before.
Yeah.
So this is the PS1 Chouaniki, yes. Which we've never talked about before, I don't think.
Oh, we've talked about it collectively.
Yeah, in hushed tones.
We giggled about the trailer in a sting, not a trailer, a YouTube video in the stinger.
So this is one that came out on the PS1 and the Sega Saturn. This is the Choaniki.
The Choaniki?
It's the same as the Saturn version?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, wow. I'm going to have to get this.
Yes. I would describe it as, number one, horrifying. Number two,
I could have sworn you were going to say reserved and mature.
Number two, I would describe it as
classy.
It's effectively cosplay Choaniki.
What?
Yeah. Because, okay, you don't
know. No, not yeah.
In all of the other games, they use kind of like cartoony art to portray.
Oh no, is this digitized people?
Yes, digitized people through the entire thing. So you know, like in the other games, when you select your two characters, you select an anime version of the girl, anime version of the guy. Well, these are literally Japanese people dressed up in Choaniki costumes.
Oh my god!
That's what you literally select from, and it is this. There's so many levels of creepy in this game.
Now, keep in mind that on somebody's resume is that they were in this game.
Yeah.
John, does it play like shit?
It's, you know, I promised myself I wouldn't describe it like this, but it's very hard. And by hard, I mean difficult.
You would describe it like that. What are you talking about?
It's very difficult. And I mean, it is, I guess it's, from what I've read, it's notoriously difficult.
Just to maintain eye line on the screen for any length of time is difficult.
Well, the problem is, I mean, the colors it uses are so garish, and your surprise, surprise, and your sprite is so large that
thank you.
It's like bullet. I'm trying. I really am.
It does translate Choaniki to like Super Big Brothers or something. I
mean, yeah.
We can't really
which
be
is
surprised.
Even worse. That actually makes it much worse. But
yeah.
Or
Super
better.
Big Brothers. You know, we've applied to return to PAX East for another live panel in March.
Live panel, John plays Choaniki.
It'll be a little while before we find out if that was successful, if we actually get to do that. But if we get to do that, I'm putting out the call right now. I want our listeners to show up to PAX East with Choaniki cosplay.
I do not want that.
Come to our panel as Choaniki characters.
You don't want that. Nobody wants that.
There's a lot of stuff going on in this game.
like what, John?
Well, the first boss is, they seem to have hired probably about four or five Japanese bodybuilders to photograph to be used within this game.
So it was the muscle march is what you're telling me.
Kinda, yeah.
Except without a bear.
The first boss the first boss of the game is a guy, a bodybuilder, sitting down with a huge metallic bulb or like ball over his groin. And out of it comes another guy sort of in a very phallic fashion. Another bodybuilder comes out horizontally out of his phallus.
Wait, so this is like an alien mouth syndrome. So you're saying like the guy's dick is another guy who also has a dick that is another guy?
I think he was trying to not use the word dick six times, but yes, that is essentially how he
just
describes
the
it.
Dick is a guy, and then he kind of turns towards you and he punches. He punches at you and you have to dodge his arms. And then the dick retreats.
I'm glad you said arms.
God, I'd really hate to be, was it Harry Dean Stanton in that scenario?
Yeah, and then he drools battery acid. It all goes downhill from there.
I would really like to have just sat in a room with an ESRB rating team as they rated this game.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, it's been taken directly off of the Japanese PSN. I mean, they've done nothing to it. It is all in Japanese. Everything is in Japanese. Even the listing in your list in the X browser or whatever they call it.
The cross-media bar.
Yeah, the cross-media player. I mean, all of that is, it's all in Japanese.
Yeah, so it's pretty much like when I got Silhouette Mirage, basically.
Yep.
But you didn't have to go to the Japanese store to get it.
Yeah, it's everything I thought it was and much more.
Is it $6 well spent, John?
Yeah, I mean, it's so crazy that I had to see it.
I might have to download this because I'll tell you a very quick story. I had a friend over earlier this week that we were actually playing GoldenEye, And I wanted to show him like more of my weird games, because I've started to realize that I apparently like really strange games, you know, like Katamari Damacy and Nobi Nobi Boy.
I think it's just a matter of, you know, when the base is so large, the fringe has got to be pretty weird. I just think it's
statistical reality.
Is that a Choaniki dick joke?
I do own so many games that some of a certain percentage of them are truly fucking bizarre. And so I thought, oh, I got to show him Choaniki on Virtual Console. And I thought, oh, this will be so funny. I'll boot up Choaniki. He'll think, what the hell are you doing? What is this game? You know, we'll have a good laugh over it. And I just remembered, it's been a while since I booted it up, and I just remembered that it's not that funny to begin with. It's a lot of the, like, weird stuff on the periphery of that game is kind of amusing. Like, when you get a game over, the countdown is, you know, like these flash frames of guys posing in strange positions.
They have that in this one, and it's...
Of course they do!
Photographs.
And it's actual photos.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that part's really funny, but like when you're actually playing the game, it's not that amusing at all.
No.
There's maybe some stuff much later in the game where the enemies are super weird and shit, but I mean, it's just not, it's not that immediately funny. And so I was like, man, I felt kind of stupid for bringing this game up so we could laugh at it, and it's like not as bad as it kind of exists in my mind.
Yeah.
So I may just have to download the PS1 and really
do over.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is with this one, it's weird all the way through. Like the, you know, how they have the countdown, like after you die.
Yeah.
The weirdest thing about that are the cosplay babies.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Because, and I'm trying to remember if this was in other Choaniki games, you know, because you have the two guys, I forget what their names are, but, you know, they come out and they shoot with you.
Shoot their man beams.
Yeah. But in this one, there are babies, little babies with halos. And so, you know how they go, one, two. This time, it's a little baby with a halo who's like, three. It's so creepy, dude. It's so creepy. I will have nightmares of it.
I
got nothing. Like, there was, honestly, there was a lot of stuff in this game where I was pretty much speechless.
I think he was going to say he was checking the curtains for shut.
This is what Nathan Fouts was talking about. You know, like, you just get to certain points in this game, you see certain things, and you just have to, like, put the controller down. I mean, there's nothing to be said about it. That's...
Yeah.
That just happened.
Like, squids made of bodybuilders. That's normal, though, for this game, though. That's not even, like... That doesn't, like, you very quickly, that stuff like that doesn't even faze you.
It's like the graphics in Kirby's Epic Yarn. It's like, no. They start to wash over you, but then it's like, oh, that octopus is made of bodybuilders.
You're making fun of me. Okay. Choaniki. There you go. I'm so glad you played this and brought it to our attention, John. I really am.
Check it out.
The listeners will be thrilled.
Check it out.
Okay. That's going to wrap up new business. Thank you for listening. And now we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll have your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with a Super Scribblenauts contest. Present your solution to our Scribblenauts puzzle, and you could win a limited edition Maxwell vinyl doll. Everyone likes dolls, so enter now.
No, seriously, enter now. I've seen the entries we have so far. For the love of God, enter now, please.
It's up for grabs.
There is no competition at all.
And moving on, we have a review for Legend of the Guardians, The Owls of Ga'Hoole.
Do you wince when you say that, Greg?
I'm just perplexed when I say it. Pedro was impressed by the Wii version of this licensed movie title. Check out his review to get his opinion on the DS edition and whether it's worth your time.
Zach's got a blog where he unboxes more stuff. This time it's his Club Nintendo Elite Rewards. There's some pictures.
I got mine. It's a statue. It's a plastic statue.
So we also have another Pedro review. This is Deck of Sports 3 for Wii. It's Hudson's Wii Sports Resort knockoff. Pedro lets us know how it stands up with its Motion Plus controls.
All right, Neil brings us a review of The Force Unleashed 2 for Wii. He breaks out his lightsaber.
No!
And gives us his take on this sequel. And what he likes most about it isn't what you'd expect.
No!
Tap into The Force, my friends, and read his review to find out what it is.
John writes these things, and you can tell he just relishes in this, hearing
his
words.
Read his own copy, damn it.
I savor it, Johnny.
God.
And another Neil Ronahan special review of the N-Space version of the reimagining of the classic GoldenEye 007 for DS. He puts that under the microscope, and he describes it as a good companion to the Wii version. Find out what he thinks about the multiplayer and how it stacks up with the N64 original.
Well, you know, it is that time of the year, and you really want to be checking NintendoWorldReport.com every day to get the latest
every
reviews
hour.
And news and all that other good stuff. All right, we're back, and by the way, I didn't say this in the first segment, but thank you guys very much for keeping the show going while I was gone. Greg did a great job as host, and I really appreciate you just filling in the schedule, and obviously the show runs just fine without me, and of course, thanks to TYP for subbing in, and as I've said before, it is such a pleasure for me, because I love our show. I mean, if I didn't make it, I would listen to it, and I would love it just as much. And so it's really exciting for me to download a show with everybody else and listen to it with fresh ears. And even just like reading the title of it and wondering, oh, what does that refer to? What does that mean? It's so exciting. It's a little bit of taste for me for what a lot of our listeners get every weekend when the show comes out. And it's just such a thrill to listen to it, and especially when it's a great episode and you guys did an amazing job on it. So,
well, then we've got good news, Johnny, because we had a vote while you were gone.
Got something to tell you. We figured we'd let you do a little bit of this podcast before we broke it to you, but
and then Johnny's like, I am the podcast.
I'm the franchise.
No, but I'm not, clearly. I mean, I'm not. So it's just, you know, it's nice to be able to take a break and just listen to the show, and it, you know, it just, it's fine without me. It's cool. But of course I love contributing to it as well. So we come now to listener mail. You guys, of course did a huge pile of it last week, but, we continue to get awesome letters every week. And I thank everybody who writes in. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please include your name and location. Just like this guy, Shaman from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, Canada writes, "It's been about 5 months since Dragon Quest IX came out in North America, and it did quite well considering the history of the series in this region. Top 10 in the NPDs in July, and probably going to get a second boost with the Target Black Friday sale." I think they're selling it for like $17 or something.
Yep.
Anyway, awesome deal. Pick it up if you haven't.
If you're up at 4 in the morning.
I am, actually.
However, I'm really worried about the status of Dragon Quest VI's localization, or lack thereof. Although they registered Realms of Reverie as a trademark last year, there's been no word from Square Enix since then. As well, it seems like every major Eastern RPG is coming out for the PSP now. The only RPG I know of that's guaranteed to hit the DS in the next few months here is Pokemon Black and White. Is Nintendo going to pick up the publishing rights to DQ6 as well, or am I going to be forced to get my slime curling on through importing? Slime curling. I'm not familiar with that.
I'm not sure whether this, and perhaps this letter was expedited by this, but there was the incident with Square Enix of Europe, on their Twitter feed or something, where someone asked if there was like an update on Dragon Quest VI coming out in Europe, and they kind of worded it in such a way that, you know, it's like they had nothing to say about it, but it kind of sounded like maybe it was not coming out anymore. And then they sort of they moved to clarify that afterwards to say, well, look, we're not saying it's cancelled. We're not saying it's announced either. We're just saying there's nothing to say about it right now. So, yeah, that's Europe, of course, which is something of a separate matter.
Especially with RPGs, it's much more expensive to localize.
There's four more languages to deal with.
Yeah. Precisely.
But yeah, I mean, based on that kind of wording, it sounds like maybe in Europe, you know, maybe Nintendo is working out a deal, because that, in that case, that would mean that Square Enix probably would not be able to comment on it at all, because it wouldn't be their title, anymore.
As you said, Europe is a different proposition, though. Yeah. It may still be on target for America. But I mean, I suppose it's well worth considering the sort of lag with the other games in the series. So
yeah, there's been plenty of lag in this
franchise. Yeah, I mean, six... So it came out in Japan, I think, at the very beginning of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're almost getting towards a full year removed. I mean, is that standard for 4 and 5, Johnny? Do you...
It was standard for 9. Took over a year for that to come
out. So. Well, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, 4 and 5 weren't quite that long, but I think Square Enix in the U.S. wanted to get 5 out before 9, so I think it was rushed a little bit, actually. And with 6, I think they probably want to wait until 9 has died down a little bit. I mean, they just don't want to compete with themselves. In this case...
And I assume there'll be certain... I know here they're doing a certain amount of remarketing for the holiday.
Sure.
For 9, that is. So, I mean, you might say perhaps they don't want to get in the way of that.
Yeah. And you know, they might. They could even have... I mean, with Nintendo publishing it in the US, and I think they did in Europe as well, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
You know, Square Enix might even have a deal with them that says they won't release the next Dragon Quest for a certain period of time so that Nintendo has a window in which they can market Dragon Quest IX without having to worry about all that crosstalk.
Entanglement, so
that, I mean, it could, and maybe that's why they can't even talk about it. So I wouldn't get too concerned. It hasn't been that long, and... You know, one of the things is, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but I think RPGs are the kind of game that as a system gets older and a lot of software sales slow down and a lot of the people who sort of casually buy games for a system move away and they just kind of, you know, it starts to collect dust in their house.
That may be the case, but there are other RPGs coming out on DS this year. I mean,
Golden Sun is forthcoming.
Golden Sun, Dark Dawn, Kingdom Hearts RE Coded is coming out in January. With its stupid name.
Par for the course for Kingdom Hearts.
Yes. Yeah, that is...
It's not the worst Kingdom Hearts title I've heard.
Oh, it's pushing it, though. And, of course, there is Black and White. There's also 999, which is a weird text-based RPG game.
I haven't heard of this. I don't know that Square needs to worry about that one. And, of course, you know, Square Enix, they just put out the Final Fantasy for DS... that James liked, and so it sounds to me like Square Enix, if they're publishing it in the US and Europe, they might wait and try to get it out either before Pokemon Black and White, so that maybe they're waiting to see when Nintendo puts that out, or they'll wait until after that.
Yeah.
Probably before.
I mean, is there any doubt that Pokemon Black and White is going to be in April? Because it's been very sort of rigidly set now, if you go back to Diamond and Pearl, and then the Platinum.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess Heart Gold and Soul Silver came out in March last year, because it was right before PAX East.
Yeah, it's pretty much always March or April.
March or April.
September, the game comes out in Japan, and then the following March or April, it comes out in the West. That's go back all the way to Diamond and Pearl now, that seems to be the way they do it. The complicating factor now, of course, is the 3DS. How they want to work it around that or not, with marketing and all sorts of things. That will complicate things in the West. But I still would have thought it would be in that slot anyway.
Well, I do think Dragon Quest VI will be localized to English.
And that's what would be the big deal, because this is the one that hasn't been on it before, right?
Well, yeah, five hadn't been either, so yeah, this would be a very big deal. Very big deal. And 6 is considered one of the best games in the franchise as well. It was a Super Famicom game, and it didn't come out, so Dragon Quest had long been abandoned by the time this game came out. But I think the best possibilities right now are, could definitely be a February release, especially if Pokemon's coming out in March. If Pokemon is gonna wait until like April, then I think Square Enix might try to get Dragon Quest VI in around the 3DS launch, just kinda like Capcom's doing with Okamiden, so that they pick up, you know, cause there's a lot of foot traffic when a new system launches in the store and people are looking for games. So it might be one of those things where they try to launch Dragon Quest VI with a sticker that says plays great on 3DS, you know.
Especially, I mean, it depends, like, you know, we've seen a lot of these games for 3DS, yeah, they're going to be out early in the system's life or whatever, but literally how many will be at launch is not clear yet.
Yeah, right. And how many RPGs? Zero. Yeah.
Exactly. It could be quite a thin field, so they might think that, you know, the, despite the fact that, you know, publicity and all that kind of stuff is going to be overwhelming for 3DS stuff, in terms of that foot traffic thing, your shelf space and whatnot, that they it could be viable.
By the way, I'm not really worried that about Dragon Quest VI being localized. The one I'm kind of concerned about is Ni No Kuni.
Yeah, that game's never coming out.
I really want it to. I mean, it sounds great. It's been getting really good buzz in Japan, and
it's
kind of languishing though. But you know, it's just kind
of sitting
there.
How much of a barrier do you think the spell book is?
Oh, it's huge. It's gigantic. You can't play the game without it.
Right. It's expensive to localize the book that comes with Ni No Kuni, but that also makes it worth bringing out because it thwarts piracy. So I mean, that actually gives you greater confidence that the game will actually sell to the people who want to play
but
it.
But what about this, so what comes with that? You know, from the point of view that as we, you know, don't sort of have to deal with necessarily, although there is the whole Square tax thing. But in Japan, you know, games like GQ9 are basically console type pricing.
Yes.
Whereas,
yeah.
You know, it isn't that here. And the thing is, something like Ni No Kuni is that surely would have to be premium priced.
Could be $50. I mean, I don't think that's unreasonable.
Would they think it's just commercially, you know, being as it would be far more of a niche product in the West than it would be in Japan, a premium priced handheld RPG at the end of said handheld's life is just... You're pushing it.
Well, I think
maybe the PS3 game's got a better chance.
I think it would be difficult to get shelf space for a DS title that comes with a big giant book and is also a relatively niche title.
I'll buy it as long as it comes in a collector's edition.
I mean, that's the thing. This DS game basically is a collector's edition.
Yes, as long as the book is big, unnecessary.
Is there a version of this I can get with the second book that has spells that aren't in the game?
Do you have a larger book? Maybe something I can put up against the wall?
So to complete a thought that I had earlier, it's that as a system becomes very old, the remaining market for software that actually has a chance of selling is basically super cheap budget games, you know, like just stuff that people don't even think about. It's like, you remember the era of $10 PS2 games?
Ugh.
Brand new $10 PS2 games. I mean, just awful shit, right?
Direct, yes.
And really hardcore stuff, because the people that actually know what Ni No Kuni is don't care that it's on DS and not 3DS. They just want to play it. So, I mean, there is this niche Atlas style. It's a small market, but as the system gets older and older, those people don't go away because they're not necessarily interested in the latest and greatest hardware or whatever. They don't care. They want to play the really advanced, mature, not mature as in rated M, but like, you know, the games that use the hardware the best because the hardware is so old and the developers know how to use it. So, I mean, there's always a core group of people who will buy. It's kind of like these first-person shooters on Wii. I was going to bring this up later, but I mean, is it worth bringing out like a hardcore game for Wii? Well, it depends on how much it costs to make it, because you're probably not going to hit the mainstream, but there is a core group of people who've been there from the beginning, and they're not going away. They still want to buy these sophisticated games.
Yeah, just ask Treasure.
Treasure is a great point, John. I mean, you're exactly right. Treasure is the king of doing this.
Yeah.
I mean,
but they tend to make pretty cost-efficient games.
Yeah, I mean, they're not...
Biggest DS cartridge ever produced, Epics, with Studio Ghibli. But, you know, I think that's... If you was going to release it in the West, you would have to do it on a premium basis. You're aiming
sure.
to, you know, the sort of the discerning customer, and whether they think that's viable or not.
And, look, Ni No Kuni is a premium game.
Yes. So, moving away from the DS briefly, if you'll grant me this flight of fancy.
I will.
I was going to do it anyway, so it's fine. This kind of conversation kind of bleeds into the Wii, which has had its sort of little mini resurgence of RPGs lately in Japan. And it really scares the crap out of me about the last story, because I could see this game never coming out in Western markets.
I'm sure XSEED will do it whether they can afford to or not.
XSEED can't afford to do the last story.
That hasn't stopped it before.
XSEED might not be able to afford to keep the lights on.
I think XSEED sells negative copies of the games that it releases.
The precedent
here
that's a little disturbing there is the fact that with Fatal Frame, you know, it seems like Nintendo basically had the policy that, you know, they decided not to release it in the Western markets, but they also kind of didn't get into exploring opportunities for anyone else that wanted to take the risk and publish it themselves. So that's not something they wanted to get into, apparently. So you know, if indeed Nintendo decided that The Last Story and Xenoblade were not, you know, commercially viable for Nintendo, I don't know that there is scope necessarily for an Exceed or anyone else to come in and do it just on that basis.
Yeah, I mean, it's a concern, but there is precedent. If you go back to, like, Ogre Battle 64, that was a Nintendo game in Japan, and they, through whatever dealings, they let Atlus publish it in America because Nintendo didn't want to. So
it's been a long time, though.
You're right. It's a long time ago, but it's possible.
It's a different Nintendo than the one we have now.
Yeah, I think there is a concern. I mean, we've got these cool. I mean, they look to be pretty good RPGs coming out for Wii in Japan, and there are plenty of people. I mean, there's a sizable group of people here, including me, you know, us, who would like to play that stuff in English. And I agree. I don't know if it's going to happen.
It seems especially unlikely to me that both would come out. Xenoblade and The Last Story from Nintendo. So, James, if you had to pick one.
If I had to pick
Sophie's choice.
Obviously, the difference, to be clear, Xenoblade is already out in Japan and has received very favourable notices from everything I've ever read about it, whereas The Last Story is coming out in January, so there's a bit of a difference in the impression.
Go with Xenoblade because...
Disaster.
I would go with The Last Story. And one of the things that kind of sways me on that is that the game features 2-6 online co-op.
Yeah, that is so weird. That just came out. Like, that was just revealed.
I mean, they're giving this game the royal treatment, and Nintendo is. I mean, they're releasing a bundle of the Wii with completely over-the-top Wii box art. You know, if you go to the website for The Last Story, it's basically been going since day one. Like, the day they announced the game, it's had a constantly updating website. So I feel like they think this game is better than Xenoblade, which didn't get nearly that much pub. I mean, I would like to play both of them because Xenoblade looks insane, but if I had to choose, I guess I'd pick The Last Story.
I'm a little surprised.
Well, they're not really that different, except one of them's not completely giant swords killing giant monsters.
Doesn't The Last Story have kind of like this cover-based RPG thing?
A bit, yeah. But they're both action-based combat. The Last Story looks more polished. But I don't know. I mean, I'd like to play both of them. They have to be better than Arkrai's Fantasia.
Well, yeah. Everything is.
Holy shit.
Choaniki is, for sure.
Better voice acting.
Yeah. Not really.
do the three again for me, John.
One. Two.
Three!
God.
And it's the baby with the halo.
Greg, you've got the next one.
Save us.
F-Zero Boyo writes, I was in an internet chat recently when I had mentioned two soon-to-be-released films, Kung Fu Panda 2 and Cars 2. One of the people in the room expressed some disdain at the thought of these quote-unquote unnecessary sequels. While the example was not pertinently related to games, I would like to hear your guys' take on what makes a really warranted sequel.
So, basically, he's putting us in the justify your game situation, but for sequels.
I don't know about that. But
well, I mean, that's kind of what he's getting at. Like, what justifies a game getting a sequel versus just saying, all right, that was a great game.
Well,
but...
yeah, I mean, yeah, how do you want to define unnecessary?
Yeah.
Right. That's the key, yeah.
You could argue that all games are unnecessary.
We have a loaded question.
Right. I really wish this had been a negative question at the end instead of the positive.
I think you know, a lot of the time, whether the sequel feels like it was warranted or not, comes about from, you know, the quality of the game itself, doesn't it? You know, I mean, if it feels like, oh, you know, what it did actually add this, that, and the other that the previous game didn't have, or maybe advanced the story or utilized the story in a way that you didn't think or whatever, then even something that might come out like the year after and not seem like anyone was desperate for it could then say, oh, well, this was a necessary sequel because it did a lot of good things. Whereas, you know, if the same project was just poorly executed, a derivative, you would say it was an unnecessary sequel.
Yeah, well, I think where you see it is a lot is in the puzzle genre. You'll just see sequels and sequels and sequels of games.
Best not be stepping on my Layton, son.
Are you talking about, like, Puyo Puyo 6?
Yeah, and, like, you know, like, Street...
I disagree. I need more Puyo.
That is a real game.
It's a 7 in Japan.
Okay, so I have a kind of a philosophical take on this. I think the difference between games and movies in this context is a recurring theme on our show. Is the difference between games and movies is that movies are primarily a story-based medium, and games are primarily a design-based medium. So it's easy with video games to think, oh, well, if you tweak this piece of the design, or if you kind of offer this different setting so the same mechanics are now used in a different way because you've changed the content that they're, you know, the context that those mechanics are used in, now you've got a new game. And people don't really complain about that. And that's why you get stuff like Mega Man 11, Final Fantasy 14, Dragon Quest 9. No one seems to be really bothered by that because those series aren't about a continued story through 14 games. Even in Final Fantasy, that series is somewhat story-based, but the stories are all self-contained. And yeah, that is necessary. There's a reason for that, okay?
Yeah.
Mega Man doesn't even really have a story.
That's not true, damn it.
Okay. But only James gives a shit about the story of Mega Man. And
oh, no, I care because it's funny. That's the difference.
Yeah, well, I mean, and so, you know, what I care about with a new Mega Man is what are the new bosses, what are the new levels like, what are the new powers, what have they added design-wise? So it's never unnecessary as long as the stuff you add to it is interesting. It's very different to do that in a story based medium, or even a story-based game. If you're trying to continue the story, like Assassin's Creed Brotherhood just came out, okay? It's 1 year after Assassin's Creed 2, and it basically just continues the story. And it's getting a lot of flack for that, because people like Chris Kohler had a really interesting review of this game, where he said the mechanics are really sound, the presentation's wonderful, there's a pretty cool multiplayer mode that probably wouldn't be enough for its own game. And so they added this whole campaign thing that is basically just like recycled ideas and characters and story elements and settings from Assassin's Creed 2. So even though it plays just as well as Assassin's Creed 2, it feels unnecessary because it doesn't really do anything different. And the story itself didn't really need a sequel.
But see, you used Mega Man as an example, but that series regularly gets hammered. And I mean, I hammer it all the time for its sequelitis. I mean, remember, we had Mega Man 0, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, 3, 0, 4 in 4 years.
Sure.
And, yeah.
But that's a case where you don't have a philosophical problem with them doing a Mega Man sequel. You just think that the sequel itself doesn't have enough new ideas. Yeah, and that's totally fair criticism.
Yeah, and I mean, annualized games are always the biggest easy targets for this because they are just churned out on a production. You know, because like, do we need, you know, a Guitar Hero every damn year?
Yeah,
and that's more, I mean, I thought about that like with the Madden series, which obviously gets a lot of flack for it, but I mean, those are more updates than sequels, so take on it, you know, like you expect different things out of it, because you know that it's primarily new numbers, and with Guitar Hero or Rock Band, it's primarily just new songs.
It's track packs, I mean.
Yeah. You pretty much say that about Call of Duty as well.
Well, Call of Duty's different, John. I mean, you got a story mode.
Yeah, but none of those stories are connected.
No.
And all it is just iterative versions of the multiplayer.
I think basically, I guess the closest I would say is if it was going to pin down, you know, this fairly loose idea of an unnecessary sequel, it would just be when a sequel gets made. Perhaps this was not inevitably the case, but it was the case that it was before they'd had time to actually cook up any new ideas of significance. That is bullshit, James.
Words.
Says the guy that gave it a 9.5. You're trolling yourself.
I'm saying if we have to be very careful because the Galaxy example is sitting right there.
There's more ideas between galaxies in Galaxy 2 than there are in some entire series that come basis.
See, but my point is we need to be very careful about the distinctions we're going to draw here.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, though. I think you could still... There were still directions to go in with that, with the Super Mario Galaxy concept.
I wouldn't necessarily have been entirely confident that they would have had, you know, a critical mass of new ideas to make a new Galaxy game a couple of years later, but again, the proof's in the pudding. They did.
Yeah.
It is that good.
Yeah, that's in video games, ultimately, we're more outcome-based, you know? Like, I'm game for any sequel to any video game as long as the sequel turns out to be good. Like, I don't really ever hear of, damn, they're making another Kid Icarus. They should have left that dead. You know, if it turns out to
be
good,
won't ever hear that.
Great.
No.
I don't care.
Now, where does Metroid Other M fit into this?
Oh, boy.
I was excited for Metroid M, and I'm fairly happy with the result. I don't have any problem with it. Yeah, I hope they keep making more and more and more Metroid games, as long as they're good.
Well, and it certainly wasn't so similar to another game that, you know, I mean, the most obvious culprits are the ones that are so similar to other games. I mean, you know, let's go back into the Mario series, the Japanese Super Mario 2. I mean, it's just, you want to talk about an unnecessary sequel.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was just more levels with these sort of sadistic twists.
And Nintendo of America actually thought it was so unnecessary that they didn't release it here.
Exactly. Well, and it was so hard.
It was demonstrated that it was unnecessary because they omitted it from our lives if you lived in the Western market. So
yep.
Temporarily.
That to me is kind of the template for it. Now, there's other ways, but I think in the movie example, to me, a way in which is completely unnecessary is if you have a story that is completely self-contained and it all kind of finished on a nice note and it was complete.
Yeah.
And then you start piling extraneous shite
on it
to make money.
So Lord of the Rings 4, essentially.
Citizen Kane 2, people would be fucking pissed about that because...
Because Orson Welles isn't around anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, for a number of reasons, but from a story standpoint, there's no reason for that to exist. There's nothing you could add to that story that would do it any good, that would shed any light on the original. I mean, there's no way to do that justice. But again, games are not primarily a story-based medium. They're design-based. And so as long as the game itself isn't revered for its story too much, then you can do that.
So what about a game like The Prince of Persia: Warrior Within that got killed for its sequel for just being too not a sequel, if that makes sense? Like it went too far away from the previous.
Trying to distance itself,
trying
to differentiate.
It turned him into a character from a Godsmack music video. Yes.
Yeah. I think the problem with Warrior Within is not that it was so much different from the one before, because we have, especially in Nintendo's history, you have so many examples of sequels that were very different from the game before that are equally loved, in some cases more loved. I think the problem with Warrior Within, if you're going to stick with the Prince of Persia example, is that people just didn't like what they did. I mean, the result itself sucked.
What was part of their decision-making in that to try to avoid being, well, this is just the same game over again?
Sure. Mm-hmm. It's a fine line that you balance between making it recognizable as you know, being related to the previous game, and yet different enough that it satisfies people's need for something new.
I think the flip side to this is a much more profound question, which games are necessary. Which games exist that, you know, preserve the space-time continuum?
Choaniki, probably.
Well, Choaniki, obviously, if only as a warning to future generations of what can be done with technology.
I think if we were to discuss where the line between something that's iterative and something that's really just the same sameness, it's really different based on the person, so it's hard for us to really quantify
this. Because it's how if you appreciate something on a really kind of, you know, minutiae kind of level,
mm-hmm.
small changes are significant enough to you, whereas for someone else, it's you know, appreciably the same game.
Well, that's why fans of Madden are happy to buy it every year, whereas guys like me, who almost never play Madden, mm-hmm. are just dumbfounded at the yearly release schedule.
Yeah,
right?
Well, it becomes a yearly thing for them, for those people. Like, hey, yeah, let's go and get the new Madden.
It's a habit.
Yay, it's Madden season again.
All right, well, we've strayed pretty far away, but it's a fun topic. And James has the next letter.
JCZ from Japan writes, that's awful.
Moving on up like George and Wheezy.
Oh, good lord. JCZ just got done watching some footage of Black Ops on Wii, and to be honest, it looks amazing. With this, GoldenEye Red Seal 2, and the Conduit 2 coming later, what do you guys think of all these excellent, fully featured shooters coming in so late in the Wii's life? I was just shocked to see devs putting so much effort into a genre that was really not associated with the console. Appreciated for sure, but I can't help feeling it's much too late. Also, as a cheeky quote, what if, what do you guys think a Wii FPS genre, or even the hardcore genres in general, would be like if Conduit 1 was a launch title and not Red Steel 1? Keep up the good work, guys. I listened to RFN before the Mark Kermode movie podcast this week. Greg will attest to how much of a compliment that is.
Greg?
I don't listen to Mr. Kermode's podcast. I know who Mr. Kermode is, so I don't listen to his podcast.
I'm not familiar with it myself.
He's just a British film critic with 1950s hair.
Perfect.
His favorite film ever is The Exorcist, I think.
Let's go ahead and take Red Steel 2 out of discussion, because I will refuse to call that an excellent fully featured shooter.
I just would refuse to call it a shooter. I mean, that's the fundamental point.
I'm with James. It's not a shooter, and it's not fully featured, and
it's not
excellent.
None of those words apply to Red Steel 2.
I kind of already addressed. I blew my load on the first part of the question because, you know, as I said, I think that all these first-person shooters coming out on Wii and a number of other games and other genres will do okay as long as the companies that publish them have realistic expectations, because again, there's a certain core group of people who probably bought Wii on launch day and they still want to buy Wii games, and those people aren't going away. They'll never go anywhere. You know, they may own other systems, but they are interested in the in Conduit too. But that's not a huge group. So as long as you're realistic about how many units you're going to sell and you budget your development in accordance with that, they'll be fine, and those games will still come out.
Well, and something like Black Ops, I mean, I look at that game as more of part of, you know, Activision's marketing plan more than anything else.
Right. This game has to exist because
it has
part
to
of
exist
profile.
On everything.
Yeah, but in the case of, I mean, not so much GoldenEye. That's obviously a weird undertaking in many aspects. But with yes. Black Ops and with Conduit 2, they both have the precedent of Modern Warfare Reflex Edition and Conduit 1 to work off. So, you know, they know kind of what their market is. So I'm sure the development budgets have been, you know, allocated very much accordingly. And so, I mean, that really is demonstrating what Johnny's talking about. They've identified a market there now in terms of how big it is, how much revenue is going to generate, and then they shape the development accordingly and serve the market that does exist. And I guess the reason why it's late in the day, as JC points out here, is probably because it took that long to kind of establish what the market was.
Right.
Here we are now, we've kind of reached that equilibrium position, which is, you know, at quite a small kind of low level, but enough, clearly, for people to keep making games.
Well, I think the other issue is that developers and publishers especially, probably much more so than developers, when the Wii had its initial success, that they basically said, this system isn't for traditional genres. This is for Wii Sports clones. And what we ended up with was, there was probably a, and this kind of goes to the second part of his question, there was probably a window in there in which if you had put out a really solid first-person shooter, like one of the, you know, highlights of this generation for that genre, it probably could have established a precedent for making first-person shooters on the system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But development resources on the Wii were allocated so heavily to these party games and games with broad focus audiences, because that was what Nintendo had proven was successful on the console.
We
ended up kind of missing the boat. I mean, Red Steel was successful, but it was also a launch title. It kind of launched on its own. There wasn't really any competition for it.
Yeah, there was nothing that really capitalized on it. Even Red Steel 2 is so different.
And it's so much later.
So much later, yeah. I mean, and look at Conduit. You know, if you want to look at Conduit as a trailblazer, you know, this was not a game that was created because a publisher said, we want to either tap into or, in a sense, create a first-person shooter market on the Wii. You know, High Voltage created it, you know, unsolicited, if you like, and then had to shop it around to everybody.
For a while.
And the Conduit, and I don't say this disparagingly, it quite literally started as a tech demo for High Voltage. I mean, they wanted to show off their graphics technology, and they built a game around that, basically, and I think that explains a lot of the problems with it. But no, Greg, you're right. I mean, it wasn't like this brazen attempt by Sega to say, hey, I bet we could do a first-person shooter and nobody else does.
It goes to what Jabe says about the fact that there was not a belief on the part of publishers that this market, it was, you know, viable, or, you know, that it existed at all.
I think High Voltage I think they really struggled with convincing anyone that they could sell that game.
They had to orchestrate a very calculated PR campaign to really sell that game, and that involved basically using IGN as their marketing company. I mean, in a way...
They did a lot of other stuff, too. I mean,
they did some social media stuff, but in a way, it was sort of this genius backdoor marketing.
I think, actually, what High Voltage did really well in their PR for Conduit, and for some of their other games, too, is they tapped into the group that I'm talking about, the people who want to buy these Wii exclusive games in these niche genres and will support those indefinitely. You know, these people who are really into pushing the boundaries of Wii hardware. I mean, the average person doesn't give a shit about that stuff.
Yeah,
bump mapping on Wii, nobody gives a fuck, okay? But there's this group of maybe 50,000 people in the U.S., or in North America at least. I don't know how much in other places. But there are these people who do care about that. They listen to our show. They go to IGN. They read these interviews.
They write us letters.
What percentage of the population is willing to read an interview with a developer of a video game, right? But the people who do...
It depends on who the developer is.
But the things High Voltage said in those interviews are extremely appealing to the people who would read such an interview. And they're very good about that. And they sold a lot of copies of The Conduit based on that, you know.
Especially to people who are Nintendo loyalists, where they'd basically come out and say, like, oh, you know, they built the system, that's fine, everybody else is the problem. I mean, they came out and basically fed the loyalists what they wanted to hear.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to use the word pandered, but they knew people wanted... Well, they knew that people wanted to hear developers defending Wii, because there was so much on the other side of that. There's so much of, you know, two GameCubes duct taped together and shit
like
that.
Somebody at least trying with the Wii hardware, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it appealed to me too. You know, I'm enough of a fanboy that I wanted to hear that stuff, and that's why I was disappointed with The Conduit, because it didn't live up to my high expectations. So I think with Conduit 2 is going to be really interesting, because I think that, you know, they know that there's this certain, maybe capped off number of people. But let me tell you right now, they're not going to sell more of the Conduit 2 than they did of the first one. And they know that. Sega's not stupid. Not anymore, at least. They're not anymore. So Sega knows that their best bet is to sell as many copies of Conduit 2 as they sold of Conduit 1. And High Voltage and Sega's struggle with their challenge with this game is to show the fans who bought the first one that they are making this one a lot better and are addressing all of their concerns so that they can actually sell it at roughly a 1-to-1 ratio with the people who bought the first one. And if you look at their marketing campaign and their PR and everything they say in their interviews, this is exactly what they're trying to express. Because they're selling Conduit 2 to the people who bought Conduit 1, a lot of whom, like me, are now very skeptical of this series.
Or at best, people who were excited about Conduit 1 and then said, oh, man.
Yes, they might be able to capture some of those people
who pulled up before the initial purchase, basically.
Sure. Yeah, no, you're right. That could be part of it, too. So the what-if scenario, what if Conduit 1 had been a launch title? I don't think it would have made that big of a difference. I mean, certainly, it would have shown more developers how to deal with Wii controls, I think, and how to, you know, allow for customization and stuff.
But I mean, even with that, though, I mean, there was Medal of Honor Heroes 2 or something that was on Wii quite
a
bit before the Conduit.
Game.
Yeah.
That did, yeah, you know, especially controls wise was meant to be very, very solid.
Yeah.
Very good use of it. So I think anything at launch, I mean, kind of go back to the Red Steel thing, anything at launch is such a kind of an outlier. You know, in terms of, like, well, people buy, you know, whatever, tats on the shelves to some extent. And I don't know that would have been a trailblazer for a market because publishers just, you know, aren't really going to know exactly what to do with that information.
See, I think, first off, I'm going to do something we don't do very often here and stand in defense of Red Steel.
Mm. You've done it quite a few times, actually, James. You've got the soft spot for this game.
Not necessarily.
There is a chink of light coming through that black heart of yours.
not in that, but in the role it played in the Wii sort of development as a concept in people's minds.
It has a storied place in that role. I mean, it was the first Wii game we ever saw. those screenshots in EGM, those are the first Wii screenshots in existence, right?
It was Game Informer, but yes.
Oh, yeah, okay. And then they, you know, Nintendo showed it at their press conference. It was a big fucking deal.
And it didn't work, if you recall correctly. They had technical difficulties.
Neither did Skyward Sword. I mean, I don't know if I want to put too much stock into that experience.
But what was interesting about that game, though, was that it so heavily... It found a niche for which you could use the Wii Remote. It said, all right, this is stupid. You're going to have a gun, but occasionally you're going to pull out your sword for some reason.
The anti-Indiana Jones.
And yes, and you're going to have sword fighting. But it gave a reason to say, whoa. So So not only am I going to get to use the pointer functionality to shoot, I'm going to get to use the Wii Remote to, you know, sword fight. Of course, at the time, we didn't know the Wii Remote's limitations.
Yeah.
So at the very least, the game served a role of getting people excited that I don't think the Conduit could do, because it doesn't have that kind of attempt to use all the things the Wii Remote does.
Well, for the in the case of the Conduit, I mean, they're similar games in some ways. And again, I'm not trying to talk bad about anybody, but just being realistic, they're similar games in some ways. Because again, Red Steel was basically a tech demo with a game conceded to wrap around it.
But it was more of a control tech demo, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah, it was a control tech demo, whereas the Conduit was a graphical tech demo, but not that much different in the long run. I mean, certainly Conduit has better controls, but I think if the what if is what if the Conduit had been out at launch, I think it would have just replaced Red Steel. I mean, I don't think it would have had this some kind of crazy ripple effect downstream or anything.
I'm not sure it would have had the same sort of effect, because it doesn't have that. I mean, the sword fighting is stupid, but everybody who, when it came out, was like, "You're gonna sword fight with it? That's awesome!"
Yeah, it was less generic than the Conduit was.
But that's for the Wii in general, isn't it? I mean, I see what you say. That's kind of shaping, you know, some people. Yeah, because, you know, did sell quite a few copies at launch, shaping what some people were thinking about, you know, what the Wii was going to do.
Right.
Because Conduit's more of a straight FPS.
I think for the game itself, it probably wouldn't have made a big difference. But for the Wii, it might have made a certain amount of difference as a system. It might not have, you know, caused people to imagine the possibilities quite as deeply. I mean,
Red Steel is kind of a high concept game if you think about it. It's unusual for a game to have first person sword fighting of any kind.
Yeah.
Certainly, that was almost unheard of at the time.
Star Wars Arcade.
Yes, but that was with the joystick. Yeah. That was
fair
weird.
Enough. Yeah. Or some of the PC Star Wars games. But yeah, I mean, really quite different. And then also, you know, the concept of combining gunplay and swordplay in that way was also pretty unusual. And obviously the execution wasn't that great, but if you think about it, if you abstract it to that level of the concept, Red Steel 2 is basically a very full realization of what they wanted to do with the first Red Steel.
Right.
And I think the fact that Red Steel 2 isn't a great game just kind of shows you that the concept wasn't all that interesting to begin with.
Yeah, it's one of those, wouldn't it be cool if, but it's really not as cool as you think it is.
Yeah, I mean, people love Red Steel 2, I know. I mean, I'm maybe we're in the minority on this, but I just think it shows that, you know, having that kind of cool concept alone isn't enough. You have to ask yourself, can I make a game around this?
I enjoyed it well enough, but I think the fact is what it boils down to is cool combat. But typically, you know, certainly games I enjoy, combat is quite a minor element of it.
It's filler, often.
Certainly the case of a really well-crafted boss encounter, it could be more than filler. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it certainly is used as filler an awful lot, you know, sometimes to the detriment of a game. But you are looking for other elements. You're looking for, you know, it could be exploration, it could be puzzle solving, it could be a lot of different things.
It could be story.
Pure combat games, you know, like brawlers, they have limited sort of capacity to entertain and are usually best enjoyed in co-op, which, of course, you'd have to do online with Red Steel.
Well, hopefully we address those questions. I believe John has the final email.
All right. Adolf Vega writes, "Thank you, Greg, for chapter breaks in RFN podcasts. So many other podcasts don't do this, and it is annoying if you lose your place in a long podcast. Everyone on the podcast should chant, hip, hip, hurrah, and cheer on Greg for his great work over the years."
There you go.
Golf clap.
The reason we have chapter breaks actually goes back to, isn't it just Mike being...
Yeah, Mike being
it was a
slavishly
off.
Devoted to Max. Yes.
Yeah, so Mike's Glenn's RFN co-founder's Apple evangelism or whatever is kind of to blame for this. And then it carried on, and James, who does not use Apple products, did not use Apple products to... edit the podcast, devised a method.
Almost alchemy, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've had a limited exposure to what goes into doing these chapter breaks on a Windows machine, and James and Greg are saints for doing this. I mean, you don't realize it's easy in GarageBand, which is what Mike and Carl used to use to edit these shows. when you're using like Audacity and that stuff, it is a pain in the ass. It's a really strange process.
Well, now we have another different process because the old process that James used it was not compatible with the new iOS 4.
Almost certainly by Apple's design. Because
we yes. had some issues that, because it was a third-party solution, you know, basically they said... that's your problem. It's on off. So we had to find something
yeah, that
else.
Was, that was the best tech support
it's,
email
it's a
I've
little
ever
bit
gotten.
Smoother now, actually. It's a little bit easier than it was. And at the moment, you know, we've had certain minor compatibility issues that we've heard reports of, but it's generally seems to be going okay. But yeah, that's not really to my credit that we have chapter breaks.
It's to your credit that you still do it.
It's an inheritance.
it's nice in a way, but... I really just used it to put in ways to mock whatever the hell we were talking about.
Visual games. Yeah,
well, there's some of that. I usually tend to put as much thought as I can. I mean, sometimes it's something that gets done late in the process, and ultimately getting the episode up on time is my principal priority. But, you know, we've had some, what I think is some pretty amusing gags. I once very, very crudely imposed John's head on the a figure from DJ Hero for his little rap intro.
Of course you did.
It was the photo from his honeymoon that he posted.
Oh,
never again.
The one on the horse?
I'm never putting any photos on the internet ever again.
There's already thousands of them, John. The damage is done.
No, it stops now.
Damage is done.
I've actually got a file where every picture... Every picture that I've ever used for the chapter art since I've been doing it, which was the beginning of 2009, nearly 2 full years of chapter arts now, is saved up somewhere. I think I might send it to someone if they want it, just as a little visual history of all the shit I've been through.
So if you're listening to this conversation, you're not really sure what we're talking about, chapter breaks and chapter art and stuff like that, you might want to check out the AAC version of this podcast feed, which is, there's always a link in the website articles, or you could just go to iTunes. If you subscribe there, you'll get AAC because that's what iTunes lists usually. Mm-hmm. And, I do recommend that because the file sizes are a little bit smaller and you get these extra features, which you may not use very much, but they're nice to have. Of course, AAC files, I want to say that virtually any MP3 player these days will support it. That may not have been the case in the past, but these days, I mean, I'm pretty sure like your Zune will play AACs and all that
yeah.
kind of stuff. Certainly, if you have an iPod, it will definitely play it.
Yeah, like mine doesn't, but newer ones in that series do.
Yeah, I think virtually any modern MP3 player will handle that, and that is the recommended version of the podcast. So if you're listening to, if you're downloading MP3s every week, then you're missing out on, you know, these... They're minor features, but they're neat. And certainly, you know, Greg put some work into them. So it's worth checking out for sure.
And AAC, of course, is now the preferred audio format of Nintendo because
yes.
the MP3 versions of the photo channel...
Because they cost money.
The license fee was too onerous, clearly, to retain. So they've traded that out in the Wii for AAC and the DSi. Has
right.
Supports AAC, and presumably the 3DS will continue that. So that's something to consider, I suppose.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, comments on the show, anything you want us to talk about, please send us an email, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We really enjoy reading everything, and we try to get as many as possible onto the show. We have a quick update on the live show that we announced recently. The blog post is now up on Nintendo World Report, so you can get all the details. And we're calling it RFN, doing it live for the kids.
Oh,
it was Greg's
it's a family
little contribution
show.
There.
It's for the children. Come on.
Yeah. But of course, we are trying to raise money for Child's Play. It's a great charity, and this is our... all day long telethon style podcast. Basically, the more people donate, the longer we'll stay on the air within reason. And we are really busy planning a lot of exciting content for that show. We're pulling in some special guests. I've sent out a lot of requests, and I've gotten one positive response so far for a guest we've never had before, and I'm really excited to get him on. So We really do have big plans for this. We hope everybody will be able to participate. And I think just the by virtue of this thing being live, it will have a different flavor. And
salty is the word you want.
Salty, yeah.
I think that's the normal flavor.
It'll be a chance for us to have some really fun immediate response live interaction with the audience that we haven't been able to do very much before. So especially if you wanted to come to the PAX East panel earlier this year and you weren't able to, I think this will be similar in some ways. I mean, there are just certain things that you can do at the panel that that we can't normally do because we record the show and edit it. So anyway, I'm very excited about the prospects. And like I said, we're planning a lot of really cool content that'll make you want to keep listening all the day long and keep donating money. And of course, if you can't donate, if you're certain, you know, whatever your circumstances are, if you absolutely can't, you're more than welcome to listen and just support the show that way. I mean, you know, in any interaction we get from the audience will help make the event go better and be more interesting. And so the people who do have the means to donate will be more likely to do so. So we want everybody to participate. It's certainly, we're not gatekeeping here. We want everybody to listen and,
we're handing out admission tickets, bitch.
And hopefully donate.
And you could donate now. There's no need to wait.
That's right. The donation box is up. If you go to that blog post on the website, you can go ahead and donate now. And of course, any early donations will count towards our goals and will count towards unlocking.
My goal is buying a Ferrari.
Just an FYI. We've just got the progress bar filling up with like flame trails leading up to John's head sticking out of the sports car.
I thought we were trying to get 200,000 so they could mysteriously be routed to the Auburn Athletics Department.
Oh, fuck you. All donations will go to Child's Play, I promise. It's actually built in. We don't even touch the money. It goes straight to Child's Play's PayPal address.
Damn it.
So you can feel safe and secure with your donation. It is tax deductible, I believe, if you root around at the Chip-In website.
I'll be on this podcast in silent protest.
I'm not
doing it for the kids. I'm not.
John's doing it for the Ferrari.
I was doing it for me, and if that can't happen, I'm out.
Well, John's about as childish as a World War I veteran can be, so it's fine.
Oh, wow.
It's not funny at all.
So anyway, the RFN Live Telethon is coming up Saturday, December 4th. It starts at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. And it's going to go on long enough that I think no matter what time zone or what country you're in, you will be able to hear at least part of it. And if you have to get up early or stay up late for it, it'll be worth it, trust me. You'll also get to hear Greg awake and sprightly during the daytime.
Fear you're overselling it, but the idea that I'm ever sprightly.
I have no first person evidence of sprightliness.
Remains to be seen, doesn't it? So we're really excited. We'll hope you participate. Definitely go check out the blog post and get more information about what's coming up with that. So next week, we're going to have an abbreviated episode for you. We're going to do some retroactive on The World Ends With You, and we'll have a little bit of a teaser for the live show, but it'll be a short episode, and you know, because it's Thanksgiving, and we got travel and stuff, so, or at least some of us do. Yeah. Greg's fine. It's just another week for him. But
yeah, well, you get Donkey Kong before me.
Oh yeah, there are advantages.
That's right. You can actually go get it right now.
British are heathens, anyways.
John just goes straight for like.
You still belong to us, John.
It's right, all. John still.
It's all not trying to marry away to be an American that wash with the Queen, son.
Hey, man, I'm American now. What is the King going to come over? That's what I got guns for.
Wow.
Okay, so.
Don't tread on John's head. It's slippery.
So, as of right now, we're planning to have a short episode for you next week. And then after that, the next thing you'll hear from us is the live show on December 4th. We won't be recording a normal episode that week so that we can focus on the live show, and so you will need to show up on Saturday to hear that. We'll have more details for you next week, so stay tuned, and thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Later.
Thank you.
The AAC also sometimes has things like links in there if we're talking about something.
The new method doesn't really support that.
What? Yeah. Oh, that's too bad. But
not like I've got much choice in the matter with this compatibility bullshit.
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's only so much we can do. Well, they had links, so if you go back and listen to old episodes, you can see what we were talking about.
Yeah, you could just jump straight to John's conduit review.
Right.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up the show. Thanks to everybody.
Oh, this low exile. The passive aggressive low exile.
I thought maybe John had died or something. What was that? No response. No response.
John, are you here?
I'm here, man.
Yeah. Oh, he's exiling.
I'm here. Oh.
The real John Lindemann.
All right. Well, if we said anything that aroused your anger or... just
good.
Gave you an idea, or you just had some comment on.
Are you talking to me or the listeners?
No, to the
now.
Listeners. I'm doing the outro.
Okay.
John, since when have we cared about rousing your anger?
Yeah, really. I was like, wow, where's this concern coming from? Jeez.
Yeah, we've long since learned not to take your silence as a sign of disapproval. Or...
just to take your silence as a sign of apathy.
Yep. Silent protest, usually.
It's okay, he's working on now playing. So
we finished 3 hours ago.